Test, test. Sorry for the little delay today. I had to record the lecture by myself again because the official recording is not here today. I hope everything works. I tested it out. Yeah, let's hope the best. First things first, I already transferred the points regarding the submission to Studon. If you participated in that lecture, in that submission, please check whether your points are correctly transferred, so we can correct it if they are wrong. But I've seen already more than 30 people have passed the 72 points requirement for the mock exam, so that's pretty good, I guess, before the last submission starts today, even. Okay. With regard to the lecture, we stopped at the last subsection of clustering last time. Have there been any questions regarding clustering at all the topics before the evaluation of clustering section? Have there been any questions regarding that? Okay. Then let's go to the last subsection of clustering, evaluation of clustering. Of course, we have to check whether our clustering results are good, and we should be able to check it even if we can't visualize the clusters well. The most clusters we talked about in the exercises, we have always been able to just visually evaluate our clusters. For example, if we have 6 points and we have 2 clusters, that seems to be fine, of course. However, if we have not coordinates, for example, but we have distances between names, let's go with names, it's harder to assess whether our clusters are very good. And if you remember the last lecture, or even the second to last lecture, if I remember correctly, then we talked about what are good clusters. We want a high intra-class similarity and a low inter-class similarity. So high similarity within the same cluster, while we have a high difference, high distance between points of different clusters. And basically, that's what we want to check, what we want to assess. For this, we have different methods again. And we start by assessing the clustering tendency. This is basically based on the idea that we can have a non-random structure, any non-random structure you can think of, and we want to check whether this exists within the data or not. And we can, calculate the probability that this structure is generated by a uniform or whatever distribution. Because if we have a random just distribution of data within our room of data points, then of course we couldn't prove that we have a non-random structure. And that's basically the Hopkins statistic. Let's say we have a data set X with a lot of data points in it. Let there be N data points. And we sample these data points randomly. So we randomly take m of these n data points. And now we can use these sample data points within our space, our data space to define distances, or to calculate distances, not define distances. Distances should be defined beforehand. Then we can calculate the Hopkins statistic in multiple dimensions, can have d dimensions for that, by using this formula down here. Hopefully, my pointer is also visible within recording. I can check that right now, but let's hope for it. And we can calculate two different distances. One is the u distance, which is the minimum distance from point y to its nearest pattern in x. It's a part of both parts of Hopkins statistic. And one, the w, is a randomly selected pattern. We have selected that pattern up here. And if we now have that pattern, that Hopkins statistic calculated for our randomly selected pattern, our randomly selected sample of points, and all the distances we have calculated, then we are able to check under the null hypothesis HO that Hopkins should be around 0.5, roughly. If we have a uniform distribution. However, then we have patterns that are aggregated or clustered, then H, so the Hopkins statistic, should be larger than 0.5. And we want to reach 1.0 for very well clustered data. So this formula can now be used to assess statistic-wise how well clustered our data is. That's something we can do without knowing an intrinsic truth, an extrinsic truth. So we do not have to know a data set that is already checked, which is nice. Something that is also statistically possible to do is to get to a good K, for example, for K-means. Because right now, we have to estimate a good K. We have to estimate how many clusters we want. We can use statistics to get to a good enough K, for example. Of course, we can use it in other methods than K-means. It wouldn't make sense to do that within a density-based method like dbScan, because where we do not apply a certain number of clusters, we will receive any number of clusters. One method is an empirical method. We simply take the square root of n divided through 2 of a data set which has n points, and therefore receive a good enough estimate for a good k. So let's say we have what's a good square root I can take within my head. Let's go with 8 points. We take 8 points divided through 2 is 4. Square root of that is 2. So we would take 2 as a good k for 8 points. And of course, we can do it with many more points as well. Um,
Another method is the so-called elbow method. So this method, because it's a turning point method. If we sum the within cluster variance, and that's that requires us to run through the clustering algorithms multiple times, then at some point we will get to a turning point. And that turning point is the point we should take as the amount of clusters we want to test. Or not, the turning point is not the amount of clusters we want to take, but the clustering run through where we have that turning point is the amount of clusters we want to take. And of course, we can have a cross-validation method where we simply take, simply split the dataset into multiple points. We use all all parts but one to obtain a clustering model, to train a clustering model, and to test the dataset, to test the quality. Check it with these things, and for any k above zero, we repeat it n times, measure the quality of the clustering result, and we simply take the clustering result that is best. That's obvious, I guess. Besides the Hopkins statistic, that is only to assess the clustering tendency, but not really give us a 100% safe measure of clustering quality of the quality of the clustering results, we can also use several other methods. And even if clustering is an unsupervised method, we can assess the clustering tendency either supervised or unsupervised. Supervised is basically we know which points should be in which cluster. Of course, since we it's not classification but clustering, we wouldn't have names for these clusters. We have simply one cluster, cluster two. Most often, these clusters for supervised clustering measuring clustering quality are more like point A should be in the same cluster like point B. Point B should be in the same cluster as point C. Point D shouldn't be in the same cluster as point C, and so on. That's most often how these ground truths are available. And we have, of course, also unsupervised methods to check the clustering quality. The supervised methods include, for example, BQ precision or recall matrix. The unsupervised methods include the silhouette coefficient. Let's go to the extrinsic methods first. So the methods where we know the ground truth, where we have a ground truth available. And let's say we have a clustering C, a clustering result C, and we have the ground truth available C star. And then we basically define the clustering quality as good if, at one side, our cluster is homogeneous. So we have not many results within our cluster that shouldn't be there. On the other side, cluster completeness. Points that should be in a cluster are in our cluster. Only some, and the less there are, the better, might be not within our cluster. Um,
if we put a point into our cluster that shouldn't be there. So we hurt our cluster homogeneity, then that should be penalized more than throwing it away. And if we split a large cluster of 100 data objects, of course, on a real data set, it wouldn't be that large, but that wouldn't be a large data set, but let's go with 100. We should penalize that less than splitting a small cluster. So let's say we have X cluster, and we go with an O cluster. One thing, so cluster homogeneity is we do not want to have X within our O cluster. Cluster completeness for the O cluster would be that we do not want many things to leave our cluster, to be outside of the cluster. The regback is that that X is worse than that O missing. And the small cluster preservation, I think that's the most obvious thing, is of course, if we have these two clusters and we split this into two clusters, it's worse than to split this bigger data set, bigger cluster into two clusters. Of a ground truth, of course, based on a ground truth, because we do not have anything other available. I think the silot, okay, I've removed the silot coefficient due to time concerns, but the silot coefficient is basically very often used because most often you do not have any ground truth available when clustering. That's why you are doing clustering and not classification. And therefore, intrinsic methods are even more often used to evaluate your cluster. And the most often method to evaluate your cluster quality is the silhouette coefficient, where you basically try to draw a silhouette of your clusters. The mathematical method is working like that. Try to put the smallest silhouette possible around your cluster, and try to minimize that silhouette thing. Of course, that's not part of the exam. That's why I removed it from here. However, a lot of libraries include that silhouette coefficient, and it's a good way to check whether your clustering quality is good or not. So that's why I talk about it, even if it's pretty quick. Okay, so clustering was a big chapter, again, two lectures, where we talked about four different methods. Model-based methods are not in here, we talked about partitioning methods like k-means, okay, k-medioids. We talked about hierarchical methods like Birch, and somewhat about chameleon, very quickly. We talked about that. We talked about density-based methods, dbScan, and also the extensions, not real extensions, but the more advanced methods like optics and denclue, and we talked about grid-based methods. There are other methods in clustering than these four categories. There are eight we named during that lecture, but there are even more. Of course, we can't talk about everything. If you're interested in that, You should visit a clustering only lecture that only focuses on clustering approaches.
However, I would say for KDD, K-means is very important because K-means is very often used in the real world. K-means is implemented in a lot of libraries and it's used very frequently, even today. DBSCAN is also very important for KDD because it's a good example for density-based methods. However, it's less often used because there are more advanced approaches and that are more difficult to explain in the realm of a lecture, therefore we opted out of explaining them. However, DBSCAN is also implemented in a lot of libraries, and you should also understand basics of hierarchical methods, agglomerative, divisive, clustering, these two directions, for example, and of course also the basics of grid-based methods, like string and click. Of course, there are even more methods exist today. I had a question in the forum regarding clustering methods. There, the methods we talked about during the lecture haven't been the most current ones and the most used ones today. That's basically because the most current ones are even harder to explain, even harder to understand. You should first understand the basics, and then you can go to the more advanced methods, of course, as always. Okay, and we quickly talked about clustering, the quality of clustering results. We talked about that, pretty quickly as well. So So we can go on further. Are there any questions about that chapter? Okay, if not, we can go to our last chapter and hopefully switching this is working as well. Okay, seems like that. Our last chapter is a chapter on outlier analysis. And hopefully we finish that within 1.5 lectures. So we have some time next lecture to talk about the exam, to go through a few questions regarding the exam. Okay, outlier analysis is something you should already have thought about a little bit, because during our data lecture and also during our pre-processing lecture, we quickly mentioned outliers. We already talked about outliers in a two-dimensional numerical space, where we had, for example, a box plot analysis, and we were able to identify outliers as something outside our interquartile range. So, for example, in a box plot, you might have outliers, and most often these are defined, for example, as 1.5 times the interquartile range. For example, might also be 2.5 times interquartile range or things like that. But of course, that's only possible within a numerical realm, because how would you define the interquartile range within a non-numeric, within a categorical realm of data? How would you define it in a multi-dimensional way of data? Because you, as students, are multi-dimensional. We can describe you in many different dimensions, in many different attributes. And there might also be outliers in a data set containing your information that we want to detect. And basically, that's what we are talking about today, about detecting these more advanced outliers. And therefore, we talk about outliers and outlier analysis first today, then we talk about some methods, then about some statistical approaches,
proximity based approaches, and then we summarize the whole thing again. Let's get to what is an outlier. An outlier is defined as a data tuple that deviates significantly from a normal data tuple. As if that tuple is generated by a different mechanism. That is true for something like this, where normal data tuples are within our intact quartile range. And it applies for our more advanced outliers we are focusing on today. First things first, very important, noise points are not outliers by default. And outliers are not noise by default. Noise is a random error or variance or things like that that mostly appear in measured variables. For example, temperature. There might be a small fault within a temperature sensor. These noise errors should always be removed before even thinking about outliers. Outliers, in comparison to noise, are very interesting. Because they violate a mechanism that we think is the base of our assumptions. Well, not that we think that is the base of our assumptions, but the most information in knowledge discovery we get out of the points that aren't outliers. That's the normal behavior. For example, if we analyze customers, then the most behavior we get from real tuples that aren't outliers. However, sometimes it might also be interesting, or most often it's also interesting to understand why some tuples do not behave the way we have learned. Why is there a customer that does buy 500 items a day? That would be a nice thing to get to know why we have that outline. And these mechanisms are very interesting to understand because we can learn a lot of things by that. And basically, we use outlier detection at an early stage to, in the next step, maybe even do novelty detection to find new ways of doing things. The applications of outlier detection are very broad because one very important thing that is very often used today, or hopefully very often used today, is fraud detection. If you have a credit card and buy something from a store, online store, offline store, whatever, we shouldn't have alert triggering at our bank. However, once you lost your credit card, you want someone to notice it, even if you didn't notice it. And that might happen, for example, if my credit card gets used in Australia, all of a sudden, then that's an outlier. And we can use that to detect a possible fraud that someone, for example, stole my credit card. Okay, Australia is less likely, but maybe someone copied the date of my credit card. We can use it for medical analysis. A tumor can be classified as an outlier within our data. The cells of the tumor might be outliers of the cells within our data. Not our data, within the cells of our body, We can,
for example, use outlier detection to detect if a machine is getting faulty.
All these things are outlier detection. Sometimes outlier detection has some overlaps with other methods we already talked about, for example, classification or also clustering, which is something we will talk about shortly. But first, we have to talk about types of outliers.
Since we only talked about this type of outlier, we have to go back to that.
We have three kinds of outliers: global, contextual, and collective. A global outlier is the easiest or most obvious kind of outlier. If a point deviates from the whole data set we have at hand, then it's a global outlier. One point, or even multiple points, but at different angles, deviating from rest of the data set is obviously an outlier, and it's a global outlier, because it deviates from all the other data.
However, if today you measure a temperature in Erlangen of minus 4 degrees, and we would really measure it, and it's not a measurement fault, of course, but if today we have minus 4 degrees Celsius out there,
in the mid of July, that's not normal for Erlangen at this point of year. However, in the winter, minus 4 degrees Celsius are pretty normal. And therefore, we have the next type of outlier. We have a contextual outlier, where we have to know which are the parameters we assume, and then we have to check in that context, is that data point an outlier or not? And in the mid of summer, being minus 4 degrees, is pretty obviously an outlier for Germany. For the global, for the whole year, it isn't. Therefore, it's not a global outlier, but it's a contextual outlier. Because within the context of it being summer in Erlangen. We can have contextual attributes defining this context, for example, time and location, and we can also have behavioral attributes that define more the characteristics of the attribute doing that. And the last thing are collective outliers, where we not only have one point,
single points being outliers, but the whole group of data points being special,
which is a collective outlier, a subset of data that collectively in that group
deviates from rest of data.
For example, in this case, you might regard that, depending on your definition, on your thresholds, these three points as a collective outlier of that big group, because there are multiple points that deviate significantly from the whole data set. So three types of outliers: global, simple kind of outlier; contextual, where the context is important; and collective, where a whole subset of data deviates significantly from the whole data set. Very important, these data, these outlier types are not exclusive to a data set. A data set might have global outliers and at the same time have contextual outliers. A data set might have global outliers and at the same time has collective outliers. A collective outlier itself might also be contextual or global, because the group might deviate from the whole data set or only deviate from a subset of the data in a specific context. These things are not exclusive to each other.
Of course, if I'm a global outlier in my specific context, I will also most often be a contextual outlier. If I have minus 100 degrees Celsius in Erlangen measured, this is likely both a global outlier and a contextual outlier, because even in winter, minus 100 degrees might be contextual, and it will be an outlier, probably. So we have different kinds, and these different kinds are, of course, not that easy to detect. A global outlier is the most easy thing to detect, while a contextual outlier requires us to first check the context and check multiple contexts to find an outlier. While a collective outlier has a problem that they have to define a threshold, because otherwise, if we do not define a threshold, we might regard it as a normal part of our data set. We have some challenges within outlier detection. Because at first hand, we want to have a clear split between normal objects and outliers. We want to separate them very precisely. And if we have an application, a realm we are working within, then it's very possible to find all normal behaviors within our realm. It might also change over time, our normal behavior. Years ago, let's go 50 years ago in the Western world, people that are today pretty normal might have been outliers. For example, if you go on the whole gender discussion. 100 years ago, being a transgender wasn't normal at all. Today, hopefully, in the Western world, it is. And therefore, a clear line between normal data tables and outliers, in my example, depending on the year, transgenders would be part of the normal people or not part of the normal people, is very hard to identify this clear line. Then we have application-specific outlier detection, where we have to find a good distance measurement among these objects to define what is determining whether things are within or close to normal objects or far away to normal objects. In this example, the definition in a numerical word, the definition of distance is pretty easy. And then we can carefully easy determine what data points are too far away of the normal points to be regarded as normal. However, in an application-specific outlier detection, that might get hard. So for example,
In any medical study, for example, even having a slightly increased blood ratio, not blood ratio, of any particle within your blood might be an outlier. Small increase in that. While having a company and you earn $50,000 more at a day, might not be an outlier. It depends on the context, and defining these thresholds, these distance functions, is very hard. The next thing that is really hard, and that's linked to our differentiation between noise and outliers, we first have to detect noise before we can handle outliers. And differentiating noise and outliers, for example, if we have sensors, is very hard. If I measure minus 4 degrees today outside with a sensor, I have to first decide whether it's noise because the sensor is faulty, or it's an outlier because it's really that cold. And doing that programmatically and identifying that automatically is very hard. If I go outside and check it for myself, then of course I can check it. But depending on your example, it might be hard to identify or to differentiate between noise and outliers. And also very hard, well, not very hard, but depending on the method, it might not be that easy to justify your definition of your threshold of your distance function of these things towards your coworkers. Because if I tell you an outlier is 1.5 times the interquartile range, that's just the limit I set. Where also outlier analysis where 2.5 times the interquartile range are required. Why did I set that to 1.5? What's my justification for that? And in more advanced methods, it gets even harder to justify things, to explain why I have put these settings in place and therefore regard these things as outliers, while with another setting, things wouldn't be outliers. Okay, these have been the outliers, the definition of outliers, the types of outliers, and the challenges of outliers. Any questions so far? Okay, then we can get to the outlier detection methods. So the real methods we can use to detect outliers besides simple methods like the interquartile range. There are basically two methods to categorize the methods. So if you want to categorize the methods, this time we do not classify or put them into partition-based methods and things like that, but we have two dimensions we can use to differentiate between different outlier detection methods. One differentiation is how we label things. Not how we label things, but rather how many of our tuples we have at hand are labeled. How many of them are already known as being an outlier and being no outlier.
Of course, we can have, again, an unsupervised approach. This is most often a totally unsupervised approach. We do not have anything labeled as an outlier and labeled as no outlier beforehand. But for the more advanced methods, sometimes we have all outliers in our training sample being labeled. So we define outliers based on things that we already know that are outliers.
What's a good example for that?
Let's go with, I think you should know what supervised and unsupervised is these days. So we can have all objects we use to train our methods being unlabeled, and it's an unsupervised method. We can have all of them labeled when it's a supervised method, and in between we have a semi-supervised method. This is the dimension, the one dimension we can use to classify our outlier detection methods. And the second dimension we can use to classify our outlier-based methods is the assumptions we use to differentiate normal and abnormal samples. For example, we could use a statistical method to define whether things are normal or not normal. Or we can use proximity-based things. How much distance is between these things? To define what is an outlier and what not. Or we can use clustering-based methods. And that's why I used that example beforehand. We can do that as well to detect outliers. Let's go through supervised, semi-supervised, and unsupervised first. I guess we can go through that pretty quickly. Supervised methods are the methods where an expert or whoever has labeled all our training tuples to being outlier, no outlier, outlier, no outlier, outlier, no outlier. And we have checked them, and we are pretty sure that's what we want to have at the end. And then we apply any classifier to that sample to check, hey, is part of the class. Outlier is not part of the class outlier. So we can, for example, use our classification methods to do that, because we have trained samples, labeled samples, and we just have to find out whether things are of one of these two classes. The easiest way to do that is to just label the things we regard as normal. And then everything that isn't suiting to that model is an outlier. Everything new is an outlier. That might become a problem if new things arise, if new things are developed. For example, let's go with an industry for this time, and we have a machine again. And we trained our classifier on normal objects, and it works. It classifies our false and good results in our machine pretty quickly, pretty accurate. And now we put a dehumidifier into our factory. Suddenly, a lot of things change. And a lot of things might be not normal according to our training data set, and therefore become outliers, even if the results are fine. Maybe they are even better. Why should we have put in that classifier? So if we simply train our model on normal things and we got any other thing as outlier, it's risky. And we should be prepared to retrain our algorithm once one big part of our assumptions change. The other way around is to model the outliers and train our classifier on these and simply regard everything that is matching the outlier model as an outlier, and everything that isn't an outlier as normal. This prevents us from automatically detect new things as outliers. However, that might not be something we want as well, because new things might be outliers, but they also might not be outliers. That's a problem with both directions. We have to know beforehand what to do with new things, or we should be prepared to handle quickly, retrain quickly, if something like that appears. Our challenges of that subsection of methods are, of course, imbalance classes. We have, in most cases, less outliers, far less outliers than you have normal data samples. In most cases, that's the definition of an outlier. Normal things are the things that happen often, and an outlier happens only every once in a while. And if you remember classification, we need a good class balance to train a good classifier. So this imbalance is a problem. We can, for example, boost the outlier amount by, for example, introducing artificial outliers. However, that's not always possible. And depending on the context, it might be important to catch as many outliers as possible. So accuracy is not our most important thing in this case, but if you remember sensitivity and things like that, we want a high recall in this case. So a high to positive thing. Depending on the method we use, of course, depending on which direction we use. In unsupervised methods, we have no label available, as we already talked about. So we have to do implicit assumptions. We can't just train a classifier on them because we can't use anything for classification. In most cases, we would simply assume that normal methods and normal data objects are somewhat clustered, depending, of course, on our definition of distance, of similarity, and things like that. Maybe we have multiple groups of normal persons, normal data objects, but we assume there is somewhat a clustered space. And now, We can,
for example, say that the biggest clusters are
normal data objects, and only the small clusters that deviate from the rest are collective outliers in our data object. Or we have a method like dbscan, where we have data points that aren't part of any cluster. Then these become, of course, also outliers, even if they are defined as noise within dbscan. But depending on if we have filtered out the noise beforehand, then things that aren't part of clusters, then yeah, they become outliers. Challenges with this method is that samples outside of that these clusters might not be outliers. They might be noise, but if we filtered out then the noise beforehand, that shouldn't be a problem. However, depending on our definition of distance, we might define outliers and not being part of a cluster differently. Let's go with grades. Yes. A simple scale from 1 to 5 within our case. And we are in one dimension to keep it simple, okay? We have some ones, we have some twos, or let's use 1.5. In here, roughly these. We have a lot of things here. We have some here. Whatever. And somewhere in between, there's just one data tuple that has whatever, 3.5. Distance is in this case defined as a Euclidean distance. Or not even Euclidean, yeah, we can use a Euclidean distance. We can use simply the absolute difference as well, and that's not a problem. In this case, because it's not two dimensions, one dimension. Now our clustering algorithm, depending on the settings, might take this cluster and might take this cluster. And this might become a point outside of our clusters. However, on that scale, I wouldn't call 3.3 an outlier. It's just happening that someone is alone on that grade. An outlier might be if we have a lot of ones, a lot of twos or 1.5s and things, and then only one person at 5. That might be an outlier because it's a huge difference between all the points. But laying between the two clusters, is it really an outlier? In most cases, you wouldn't call it an outlier. Again, depends on your outlier definition, but sometimes clustering definition and outlier definition aren't well fitted on each other. The second problem with these unsupervised approaches through clustering is that, of course, clustering methods are pretty expensive to do. However, that's something that is to be solved because we can speed up clustering with different methods. We can use sample clustering and things like that. And sometimes we might also want to do clustering. Again, it's hard to distinguish noise from outliers. A dbscan points that aren't part of a cluster are called noise because it's hard to distinguish between both. If you are 100% sure that you already filtered out all noise, then you can detect outliers pretty confidently. But in most cases, you can't be 100% confident that you filtered out all outliers, all noise. And the next thing is that it might be hard
to identify collateral outliers. I wouldn't call it impossible to identify collective outliers, because, well, let's use the PV scan again, we can always define a min points limit in the PV scan. And depending on our setting of min points, we might be able to find some flocks of collective outliers.
However, with outlier detection, with clustering, it becomes very hard to detect these things. The thing that can be solved through classification and or clustering, but shouldn't be solved by these solely, are the semi-supervised methods. Where we have a small sample of datasets that are labeled, but most of them aren't. In most cases, we have this filtering. We have most being unlabeled and some being labeled. Then we can do use these labeled examples and things to train a model, and then use this. These label things as a training sample for classification method. You might remember in classification, we sometimes also only used some of our data samples available to train our classification, our classifier. And we can do that with methods like this as well. However, if only some normal objects are available, then you should train your model on these normal things. That the two differences between training on outliers or training on normal objects. If you have only labeled normal objects available, then you should train on normal objects. The same thing applies for outliers. If you have some labeled outliers, then you should train it on labeled outliers. It depends a lot on how many of these objects are there. If you only have three labeled objects for a data set of 100,000 data objects, the results by using a classification might not be that good. Then it might be better to simply fall back to clustering. But in most cases, there are enough labels available because these labels are created to support classification. Besides that, we also have talking about clustering and classification as used for outlier detection, we can also define some very specific outlier detection methods. These have some overlaps with some known methods from clustering and classification as well, but they are fine-tuned to our problem at hand. Let's start with outlier detection by statistical methods. And basically, we are now in the second part of our definition. Where we have statistical methods, or also called model-based methods. These methods assume a certain kind of distribution behind your data sets. But something we already had within the hierarchical approaches, for example, in clustering, that we assume some basic distribution. For example, a Gaussian distribution. And then we can use that distribution to model normal data. And every data object that falls within that normal distribution or that Gaussian distribution,
every data object is, for every data object we calculate, the probability that this data object was created by the distribution we assume.
That's the right way to phrase it. And if that probability is very low, then we assume it's an outlier. But if it's high, then we assume, hey, it's a normal data object, we are fine with that. So, it's not a perfect Gaussian distribution in this case, but let's go with that being a Gaussian distribution. And we have our probabilities in here, and we have a data object at this point in here, whatever, point X in here, then it's very unlikely that this data point would be generated by this data distribution. So this would be regarded as an outlier. However, data points that are lying here or here are much likelier to be generated by that distribution and therefore are regarded as normal data objects, and therefore are not outliers. This method is highly dependent on our data, because first we have to have numerical data to use a simple statistical method. However, in however way could we otherwise create a statistical method like this? You can, of course, create some other generation functions to also work for example, categorical data. However, that's far harder. Numerical data are the prime candidates for it. But if your normal data isn't following a data distribution, for example, the Gaussian distribution, then your whole thing breaks apart, because it doesn't work like that. If your normal data isn't following a statistical distribution, you can't use a statistical distribution to identify normal data. Pretty simple. And you might have simple statistical methods, but some of them need parameters you have to set. A Gaussian distribution might be broader, might be higher, might be whatever. You have to set a parameter to identify these. What is the base? So you have to have some set parameters, you have to identify some set parameters to first be able to use that in that case. Of course, there are also non-parametric statistical models that you can use, but these are more likely to not fit your real data. The more parameters you have, the more you can fine-tune it to your specific data at hand, but the more parameters you have to get, for example, through a semi-supervised method, because you have some labeled data you can use to determine these parameters. The next type of method are proximity based methods, where an object is regarded as an outlier if the nearest neighbor of that object is far away. You need some kind of distance to determine this proximity. For example, if we have this data set at here, this data set, then objects within that region R can't be detected solely by taking a look at the nearest neighbor, because this little data point at the lower left edge, the nearest neighbor is still within that little cloud. However, if you now set it to the three nearest neighbors or four nearest neighbors, then at some point you would be able to detect collective outliers. These proximity-based methods highly rely on our distance measurements or proximity measurements, and they, of course, demand some kind of threshold to do that. When is far away reached? How many points are allowed to be close to our data point for them to not be regarded still be regarded as an outlier? In this case, we would have to define, yeah, 3 points can be close to that, and it can still be a collective outlier. The more data points you have close to that, and if we do not have more than 4 close points, it's an outlier. So we have to set different thresholds in that to, for example, be able to find a group of outliers as well, collective outliers. There are 2 major types of proximity-based outlier detection. We have distance-based outlier detection and density-based outlier detection. And these should be very well known to you, because if we go back to clustering, we also had distance-based methods and density-based methods. Clustering-based methods, so for in most cases, they are used for unsupervised outlier detection, can define outliers as points that do not belong to any cluster or to a small/sparse cluster. If we avoid R being regarded a big cluster or a cluster at all, then we could detect R as a cluster, as outliers. For example, by dbScan and setting min points to 5, then this, depending on epsilon, of course, will not become a cluster. Yeah. Okay, let's go through the approaches step by step, and I guess we can go through the statistical approaches and then end, and then we have pretty well on time to have some time next week to discuss your open questions for the exam next time. Okay, statistical approaches. Statistical approaches are, as I already said, approaches that use assumption of a statistical model below that. So we assume that objects in a dataset are generated by a stochastic process, a generative model. And our idea is to find, to identify that generative model based on a given data set, and then use that model to estimate the likelihood of something being generated by that model or not being generated by that model. The less likely that something is generated by that model, the higher the probability that it's an outlier. We have parametric methods in that case that assume the normal data is generated by a parametric distribution, so any distribution that requires us to, for example, put in a standard deviation, mean or things like that, those are parametric methods. And we use that probability density function to estimate the probability that a data point is part of a distribution or not, or is generated by the distribution or not. And at some point, a threshold is not satisfied and something becomes an outlier. And in non-parametric methods, we assume, we do not assume a priori statistical model, so we do not have a statistical model at hand beforehand. But we have some kind of method to generate or to follow become part of that. For example, we can have a histogram, draw a histogram of all our data and things that are in small bars. Bars is what I'm looking for. That are regarded as an outlier. So the bars become our clusters, more or less. If we use parametric methods, we can, for example, do outlier detection based on a normal distribution. A normal distribution should be pretty well known to you. And we simply assume that the data is generated by a specific normal distribution. Then we use our input data to train our input data set, to train the parameters we require for normal distribution. So mean and standard deviation. These are the two things we need, and we can use them to train our density function in here. This is, once we have the best fitting parts, we can simply use that function to then calculate the probability of a data point being part of that distribution or generated by that distribution or not. Of course, it's not that easy to find the standard deviation and the mean for the normal data sets, because we still do not 100% know which are normal data points and which aren't. So we have to estimate these parameters, and that can, for example, be done by the maximum likelihood method we already mentioned once or twice during that semester. We have a full slide set on that. However, that's an excursus, so it's not required for you to know that in the exam. Just to add that before we get into that. The maximum likelihood estimation estimates the parameters of assumed probability distribution, so we get to the best fitting parameters for that distribution. And we have, in this case, a likelihood function. We have a likelihood function L, not L, but likelihood function L, with some parameters parameter space. So we have some possible values we can get. And we have the observed data X So the data we want to, yeah, identify as normal. And we simply then apply this lower formula to our data set and try to maximize this formula to find the best estimate for that. This can be done for any kind of distribution, and I will go through that quickly because I want to finish at least with statistical methods. As well, where we simply have to modify our functions to fit two different methods, in this case the standard deviation and the mean, and generate two of these things to maximize both of them. We then solve that equation, and then we get to the parameters we want to have. There's a proof for that maximum likelihood estimation that is also in the appendix. However, there's no real time to do that, and it's an excursus, so it's not part of the exam. I should repeat that because, I've gone through that pretty quickly. Okay, let's focus on trying to do outlier detection based on this parametric method. Let's go. We have with some yearly temperatures. We have some place. I think it should be 12 points. Yeah, it's. There are 12 temperatures, one for each month. 10. I miscounted, okay, 10. Then not each month, but at any time. And if we then do a maximum likelihood estimation, we get to a standard deviation and a mean. The mean is 28.61 in this case, then the standard deviation is 1.451 in this case. These are all things. If we apply the recall to that, then we get 99.7% of the data that fits the assumption, and therefore we got to maximum likelihood in this case. If the plugging, we are plugging one of these values, so this 24 up here, into our formula, then we get to probability that this value is generated by our normal distribution of less than 0.15, each tail to the left and right of our normal distribution, which we assumed up here, is 99.7. Maybe I should draw it in here. Tail are these things. each tail, we have 99.7% of data in here. And this 0.15 are outside of this core distribution, and therefore we would identify 24.0 as an outlier. In the parametric methods, and that's the last thing I wanted to talk about today, the parametric methods. I think we should finish in that. We have the Grubbs test, which is a statistical test to detect outliers in a univariate data set under the assumption that it follows a normal distribution. And the Scrubs test is also known as the maximum normed residual test. And it has two hypotheses. One is that the data set contains no outliers, and one is that the data set, that can be modified, data set contains exactly one outlier. For a data set with n tuples, we can then compute this Grub statistic, so-called Grub statistic, where we simply take the maximum difference between the value and a specific mean, divided through the number of samples, through the sample standard deviation. And then, with a two-sided test and this formula, we can simply reject the null hypothesis, so HO, HO, by using this formula, if we are above or below a confidence threshold. Confidence thresholds is something we already talked about some lectures beforehand. This is a pretty simple test to find an outlier. It's getting too fast. I don't want to go further. Let's go with stop in here, and we still have enough time to talk about questions next week. Maybe I would even repeat Grub's test explanation because it was pretty quick in here. Next week we have the last lecture of that semester. If I'm not incorrect, hopefully I'm not incorrect, but let's check that. Should be the last lecture next week. So we will have some time to talk about questions on your side. If you have questions you want to have answered in that lecture, I would ask you to write them into the forum. I will open up a forum thread for that, because then we can prioritize on first come, first serve. So who asked the question forum first will get an answer first in that specific forum thread. Of course, if there's time for spontaneous questions, we can also answer them. But I wouldn't promise that. We do first come, first serve serving through the forum. So if you have a question you want me to answer during next lecture, then post that in the forum. Of course, I will also answer questions in the forum till, let's say, 1 week before the exam. At some point, I have to stop to answer questions because most questions will arise in the night before the exam, and that's something I won't be able to handle. I have other things to do in the night before the exam, for example, to sleep. The deadline for questions in the exam, in the forum, will be 1 week before the exam. Till then, I promise you to answer all of them if they arise. Besides that, today the last submission starts. 30 people of you already reached the threshold, so you do not have to do the submission to get access to the mock exam next week. But of course, you can if you want some more experience with, in this case, clustering approaches, k-means and dbSCAN. And there might also be some smaller questions about dbScan and k-means, of course, in the exam, but yeah, that's not focus. Yeah, okay. That's all for today. Remember me, please, that I have to go through parametric methods 1 again next week. Yeah, we do not miss anything next week. Have a nice week. See you again next week for last time for the exam.